Welcome. This is the podcast of Care Austria with Andrea Bastorf-Hager.
A warm welcome to Care Austria's podcast, Care in Action. And I'm very happy and proud to have a very special guest today, my appreciated colleague and friend, Dr. Musa Mohammed. Musa, welcome to Jena in our podcast.
Thank you very much.
And like always, I briefly introduced our today's guest. So Dr. Musa is 65 by now, and he is a medical doctor. Believe it or not, he has worked for more than 34 years in various roles in care. And he was born in Bangladesh. We will talk about that a little bit later. And his current position, he's the regional director of Care US and Care International in Asia. And he is based and he lives in Bangkok. But of course, he has a very deep knowledge of nearly all the countries, not only in Asia. So Dr. Musa, I know, and we have known each other for ages. I have been working in my role for 14 years now, and you remembered me very kindly when we first met. It was in the US. Our headquarters, as our listeners might know, is in Atlanta. This is the biggest member of the Care Confederation, and this was when we met 14 years ago. And since that, we have a close cooperation and we meet each other on a regular basis. And I remember from our first meeting, and it was very kind and touching that you shared it with me, you have a special personal experience because when you were a child, you were a refugee yourself. Would you share that with us?
First of all, thank you very much for having me in this podcast and having me in Care Austria. I feel very humbled and honored to be able to come and meet with you, Andrea, as well as colleagues from Care Austria who are working hard from day in, day out to help people around the world to get out of poverty, out of crisis, out of human suffering. So it's a noble work, and I feel very proud that we could be part of the same family called CARE.
Thank you, Musa. And allow me to mention that my team and myself, we could not do our work without the tremendous support of thousands of private donors in Austria and also our really appreciated institutional donors. So the CARE family is big in Austria, and this is part of our success. Thank you.
Thank you. So therefore, I also extend my thanks and thanks from the field in Asia to those donors as well as partners in Austria. Now, coming back to your question about my childhood experience, it was 1971 when we had our War of Liberation in Bangladesh, and it was a war that lasted for 9 months, during which Bangladesh, which was East Pakistan before that, fought the war to become liberated, and eventually it became Bangladesh, which is the country today. So I remember I was 12 years old. Suddenly the war started. There was an attack and genocide.
Where did you live at that time? Did you live in the capital, in Dhaka?
No, I was in a place called Kushtia, which was in the kind of western part of the country, mid-western part of the country.
At the coast or not?
No, it was close to the river Ganges, where it entered from India to Bangladesh. So I was in the bank of the river Ganges. And I remember that the war broke out in that particular city when we were in sleep, 3 o'clock in the morning. Suddenly, the gunshot, fire of the houses, killing, all this started. And I was only 12. I got up, and 5 brothers and sisters we were at that time with my mother and father. We left home without knowing where we are going. And as we came out of home, thousands of people were running. Running where, we had no idea.
Running for their lives, literally.
Running for lives, running for survival, because all you could see that killing, fire, cry, all those are going on everywhere. All fire in the houses, everywhere. And that particular running ended after 17 days, where we were walking, running, without knowing where we were going, without food, sometimes without water. It was a very difficult journey.
Where did you sleep?
We went to India.
But during these 17 days?
On different places.
You slept on the road or
We were on the road, sometimes in somebody's houses in a village, sometimes in a school, sometimes in a mosque, sometimes in a community place, because we were working every day. From morning to evening, and then when we are getting tired, we are finding out where can we get
sleep. How young was your youngest sibling?
My youngest was at that time 3 years old, and I remember my mother was pregnant. In the course of that journey of 17 days, my father got displaced because it was thousands and thousands of people, so we could not find him in the next few months. We are not sure whether he was alive. So he crossed the border, went to the West Bengal state of India, and then it was a refugee camp and a tent. So we were there. And as we were there, the remaining part of the many months, we were there. And we settled in a tent. And given the fact that I was the eldest son of that family, in fact, eldest child of that family, one of my job was to get food, and ways of getting food was to get into the queue in the morning where the relief food were being distributed. So CARE was one of the organizations who were distributing foods. It's corn, soya milk, I still remember, powdered. And so I would be coming every morning, standing in the queue for 2 hours, 3 hours, to collect that food, which will be a limited quantity, and take it back, then that would be primary food for my family. That was my first encounter with CARE, first time I learned about CARE. Of course, we had other organizations there, Red Cross being another one, and few others. Mm-hmm. And by doing that, by living in the tent, by collecting food, taking care of family, and my mother was pregnant, I learned about the feeling that a refugee child might have. I went through myself. I felt it inside my heart, the feeling of hopelessness, feeling of uncertainty, feeling of emptiness, not knowing where everything is going.
And you did not know what happened to your father in that time?
For the next few months. Of course, he was alive. Then we met again.
Okay.
But he came back, he found us out, we met. But meanwhile, 2-3 months, we did not know where he was.
And you were lucky that you still had your mother, right?
We were lucky that we had mother. Our brothers and sisters were together. I was the eldest son. Many of my friends didn't have that. But in the course, when we were running, many killings happened in front of my eyes. So I was a 12-year child. I saw only maybe 30 meters away from me, another child of my age was being shot and killed. I saw one of my uncle. He was slaughtered because at that time, those who were causing genocide, they didn't want to use all the bullets because bullets were expensive. So they slaughtered. So all those I saw houses burning, I saw people are being killed, I saw many other things.
You will never forget it, right?
It was a trauma that affected me a lot.
As a child, you couldn't deal with a trauma because you were not a doctor then.
No.
You could not have the diagnosis, I'm traumatized, I have to get help. Did you get any help on that?
No, nobody. Psychosocial issues were not an issue at that time. Issue was, so we are hungry. Mm-hmm. How do you get the food? Where would we stay? Where can you get treatment for healthcare? So immediate needs are the biggest need. It was not the need of my psychosocial well-being. But one interesting thing within all those, that I knew it was not just me. It was many families, our neighbors, our friends, our families. Everybody was suffering. So everybody saw those kind of situation. So we kind of became like stone. Feelings were less, our immediate needs were more important.
So focused on survival.
One focused could say. On fully survival. That's what, that how can I feed my family and ourselves when we were hungry?
And your younger sisters, did they cry the whole day or how did they deal with it?
They were crying, but they were also kind of coming back knowing our mother was pregnant. She could not do a lot. It was advanced stage. So each of us became responsible for something. My sister, she would cook.
Okay.
I would collect food. And within all this, we could never feed full stomach food to us. Always hungry. I remember. It was 1971. Always some level of hunger would remain.
So it is never enough.
It was never enough because how much you can get.
Mm-hmm.
But we were lucky that we left back for our village home midway through the war, because in the middle it became a little bit settled.
Mm-hmm.
War was going on, it was guerrilla fight, so we returned back slowly, went to our village home where not many Pakistani armies or others were there, so we could settle back.
And that, your house was still there?
It village house was there, because when I ran away, it was in a small town.
Mm-hmm.
That we could not go back during the war.
Okay.
But in a rural area where my grandfather was from, there is a small house still there. So when we learned that that's the place where we can go back and some it's relative safety there, we went back there after 4 or 5 months.
After 4 or 5 months in the refugee
camp? In the tent, yeah, in the refugee camp.
Did you feel sort of welcome in India? Did you have this feeling, so we are over the border now, now we are in safety, or don't you remember that?
I know that we received a tent, we received food, and I know that the authorities were supportive, but I don't remember whether it was a lot of welcoming situation or
mm-hmm.
not. We all knew that we were busy with how do we survive within that. So that was the primary feeling at that time.
Mm-hmm.
In addition, as time was going, we were feeling like whether we would go back to school anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So more and more reasons for feeling uncertain, hopeless, was coming back. At one time we were feeling this war will never end and we'll never go to school. Maybe my life will be ending there in that kind of situation. And that's one of the reasons my mother decided that let's go back to village home.
Mm-hmm.
And by that time my father came back, we went together. But in village home, even we did not have food. All villagers were suffering because nobody could participate in any economic activities. So everybody was suffering because war was going on.
Mm-hmm. So it was much too dangerous to do agriculture and all the things.
And that was one of the year when there was a big flood also.
Okay. So in addition.
In addition. So when bad thing happens, possibly many things happen together. So the crop failure happened that year. So it was not a good year.
And when did life become a bit more normal?
Eventually, after 9 months of the war, we got liberated. I feel in Bangladesh, we were fortunate. And none of us were expecting that this war will end in 9 months. But we had big fight. There were Bangladeshi freedom fighters who were fighting. Then they were supported globally, internationally, including India supported
mm-hmm.
us. So the war ended at the end of 9 months and the Bangladesh born. So it was a kind of relatively pleasant surprise because even a couple of months before the war ended, we were not sure that it will end so quickly.
Mm-hmm.
But a month or so before the, month or two before the war ended, we realized that it's going to end. It seems that we could see signs of hope.
So this was in 1972?
71.
Or one still?
Yeah. The war began exactly on 25th of March.
Okay.
And war ended on 16th of December. So it was very precise dates we remember. On the day it was ended, the Pakistan army who got stuck there, they surrendered.
Mm-hmm.
So they surrendered and war ended. It was a great feeling on that day. You can feel the feeling of being liberated, being free. And that gave us the hope that I can go back to school again, go back to our town, our little city home again. My father can work again. We can have food again.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a great feeling at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And we began to dream from that point onwards. We had a lot of struggle afterwards, but that particular experience helped me. Because subsequently, when I began working with CARE, at one time in my career, I became the country director of CARE India. Who was in charge of then supporting many of the people who were hungry, who were thirsty, who needed health care. And I became in charge of supporting them. So it was for me, CARE's work was no longer for work for those who are suffering. I kept on feeling I was on that side.
Mm-hmm.
I myself collected that food in the queue where I'm today responsible for distributing food. That brought the whole feeling different. I could relate to those who came to get support of CARE.
In a quite different way that I would be able to.
Yes, so I could talk with my colleagues in the way that I could put myself in the shoes of the people who I was working with. And that was in 2010 when I became country director of CARE India. So I could see myself that is there. Those people who are working with, I am them.
Mm-hmm.
That was one of the key strength I felt I could bring in addition to all of my professional competencies. That's the kind of internal feeling that drove my ability to do it. And I could transmit that feeling to the team of CARE India and others. I could transmit the feeling of greatness and great work they have been doing. I could transmit the feeling that the donors and partners who are helping us from all over the world, they were helping the people who I was also.
And you are also a very good symbol, I would say, for what one can achieve. If you cling to hope, if you get some help, and if you never doubt that things might become better again. And this applies still after so many years of hardship and of war in the world. This applies still to millions of people nowadays.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, our organization CARE is not running out of work. In the contrary, we have more and more people to serve. And it is incredible, but the number of ongoing wars is still increasing and conflicts, which is a rather depressing message, I think. Especially when we have heard now all together the true life experience story of Dr. Musa, which dates back to 1971. So you see, dear listeners, that the support of the work of CARE is desperately needed, and it will be even more needed in the near future. Allow me one more personal question. Let me start like that. I have visited professionally, of course, many, many refugee camps around the globe. And what always puzzles me is that the majority of people are very young, many children, and in longer conflicts, and we tend to see more and more long conflicts in the world. Many children are even born inside a refugee camp. And when I ask them, the bigger ones, what do you want to become? Most of them tell you either a doctor or a teacher. And I remember well, when I was working in Ethiopia, an Ethiopian colleague told me, don't get the children wrong. They don't know so many professions. This is why they tell you, I want to become a doctor or a teacher, because these are the persons that they get to know in their experience in the refugee camp. So how comes, when did you decide that you become a medical doctor then?
No, thank you. I will answer that question, but I would make a comment on what you just said. And that's again based on my personal experience, that despite all those hopelessness and the feeling of emptiness in refugee camp, the dream of a better future do not go away. They remain. And that's the time organization like CARE and others can stand beside those kids, the children, their families, their mothers, and reaffirm the value of their lives. Give them the hope, because that's the time still kids would like to dream for a future. You are right that the desire to become doctor or teacher are only two professions, but basically what it means that they want a better life. Life where they can play a role to contribute to the other people's lives. Because if you look into that, doctor is about others, serving others. Teacher is about others, serving students. That dream even gets more stronger. So thank you for bringing that. Now coming back when I wanted to become doctor, that's another story. I am from a rural town in Bangladesh. And my family was more or less educated. My mother had education, college. My father has education, had education. It still, I remember one of my youngest brothers, he developed diarrhea. It's a loose motion. And he suffered from the diarrheal disease for 3 days. Lot of loose motion. He was only 1.5 years old when that happened. During those 3 days, from the day two, he wanted to drink water because he was thirsty. So he was crawling, because he was only 1.5 years old, could not walk, crawling towards the water pitcher. And I remember my grandmother would pull him away from water with the belief that the water will cause harm to him, thinking that drinking water will increase his liquid motion, loose motion. So at the end of 3 days, he died. He passed away. And only then we learned from doctor that actually if we have given him water on that day, he possibly would not have suffered from dehydration and electrolyte imbalances that could have happened with coconut water in addition. He possibly would have survived. And I felt, despite that fact that my mother had school, college education, my father had education, we could not help my brother to survive. It was a very painful experience. On that day, I thought, I'll enter into health profession. And if I enter into that, I'll choose the profession because I would like to make sure that our mothers, fathers, villagers, people, they know simple techniques and tools like give water to child when they are having these diarrheal diseases, vaccinate child when they are not still suffering from infectious diseases. Simple, simple things. If we can help our citizens to learn, they can possibly help their children and mothers to survive. So I kind of developed that feeling that I want to be a doctor. But I wanted a doctor not for becoming a doctor, but I wanted to help. So then my journey began. I came back after the war, liberation war. I studied hard because it was not easy to get admission in medical school. I was fortunate that I got admission. And my mother only asked me that, are you sure you want to be a medical doctor? I said, yes. She asked me why. So I told that story. She told me, if you are planning to dedicate your life for others, go to medical school. But if you are planning to use this profession as a profession for earning money, don't do it. Because there are many other professions where you'll be earning more. And I remembered that day. And I chose to become a medical doctor because my mother told, make sure that you are dedicating your life for others. So I kept that as kind of my future journey. And I went to medical school with that objective.
So this, I don't want to call it a story because it's a part of your life that you so generously share with us. I assume that your brother died in the 70s?
He died in 70, in exactly 1970, a year before the war broke out.
Okay, so 50 years ago. And we very often hear and read, and I'm sure this is also true for our listeners, that children in some Asian and African countries, also in former times in Europe, possibly can die from such simple things like diarrhea, where it's really easy to get treatment. And it was also in the 70s possible to get treatment. So again, this is the daily life of millions of people who have not access to primary healthcare, because we are talking about primary healthcare. And just to remember all of us when the world suffered from this enormous pandemic, COVID, and I know that also in Asia, in Asian countries, there was a certain reluctance to getting vaccinated, and the same here, very much here. This experience paints a bit of a different story, because medicine is something that is life-saving, and millions of people are still, just because of poverty, lack of knowledge, lack of access to education, to clean water, they lose their lives because of some small incidents. And this is where the work, the humanitarian work of care starts, and this is why it is still so important. Care helps all those people to fill the gaps that they are facing and suffering from because of isolation, living in poverty, or simply the possibility not to go to school. It's simply not there. And when we talk about Bangladesh today, it's a proud nation, a proud country. It's super densely populated, right? And it has a high impact on my professional views to visit refugee camps. And we might remember that the Rohingyas that are living in the south of Bangladesh in the largest refugee camp of the world, I would say they are a sort of forgotten humanitarian crisis. And this is something that Care Austria is really focusing on, those humanitarian crises that are long lasting, that are not in the media any longer, and that really millions of people suffer from. And the Rohingya are such an example, and Care Bangladesh and Care in Asia is supporting them. So what comes to your mind when you think about the Rohingya camp? What is the first? Is it again that you think this could be me, or I was like them?
Definitely, when a major influx took place from Myanmar to Bangladesh, especially in 2017, I was there. I had the opportunity to see those people, meet those people who are coming in. They did not come in one day. They were keeping on coming over the months. And I had that feeling that I know who are coming. I know the feeling they have. I know their reasons why they are kind of hopeless. Their eyes were vacant. So definitely I felt in that way. But then, like I had the opportunity to have a tent. They also had shelter, temporary shelter, and then a little bit more farmer shelter in the camps. And we began to work. As care, we began to work not only with the immediate needs of those Rohingya refugees, be it children, be it their mothers, be it the youth, be it other groups. We began to work with them, but also we managed some of the camps on behalf of a large consortium. That management entailed making sure that you provide holistic support. Holistic means a support not just for one thing, not for just health, not for just food, not for just water. It's not for just education. Mm-hmm. You come up with programs that can meet the needs of basic services.
And daily life.
And
that
daily
enables
life.
A certain routine, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And enables
so that people can
daily
survive.
Life.
Mm-hmm. Now, with time, as you rightly said, that in 2018, they were in media. But over time, it's a kind of forgotten issue. But those people are there.
Mm-hmm.
They're still suffering. Mm-hmm. They're still facing the challenges. Some of the unique things that I did not notice in 1971, I did not notice when I was in the refugee camp, I began to notice was like issue of how adolescent girls were facing insecurities. It was new learning. They were kind of facing insecurities to protect themselves from potential harassment, exploitation.
Going simply to the bathroom at night is a risk. Yeah. In a refugee camp for a girl.
They will be raped.
Mm-hmm.
They will be trafficked.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to really put extra effort for those girls under the heading called protection, where we organize them to primarily make sure that there are collective ways of protecting themselves from the issues. We build relationship with the local law enforcement agencies just outside of the camp, like police, so that we can build mechanism by which external people are not coming in to cause harm to those people. So many risks are there. So additional program. Another program we undertook at that time when they came in was psychosocial counseling. Lot of children were in need of counseling in the groups and individually. Lot of mothers needed it. Lot of women who got raped, in fact, they got raped in Myanmar before they left in, or even inside Bangladesh. They needed counseling. These are some of the newer intervention that we did not notice at the time when I was in the refugee camp.
Mm-hmm.
With time, I think the humanitarian and development community learned about it and began to take care of this. So we put professional counselors who knows how to do community-based counseling.
Mm-hmm.
We put professional agents who can really help mothers to deal with issues and prevent issues like that, psychosocial counseling. But also how to deal with protecting themselves for this kind of incidences. Those are very newer interventions.
Mm-hmm.
And those are, I felt that are different. In addition to ensuring food, in addition to ensuring medicine, in addition to ensuring water, in addition to ensuring sanitation facilities, the newer interventions were coming up. We had to open up schools and not traditional schools. We found out that children of age 3, age 2, age 3 years, 4 years, they needed help. So we formed something called child-friendly spaces together with the help of UNICEF and donors support from Austria and other countries, where those money were creating small, small child-friendly spaces where a group of children will be coming together. They would be doing, they'll be playing together in the way that is more known to them from their cultural setting. They'll be chanting rhymes,
mm-hmm.
poems from the days that they were living together. So those are building kind of connection between them. So these are some of the newer interventions we did, which are extremely impactful, extremely helpful, and that those are still continuing. We are building on those.
Dr. Musa now provided really some good insight in two things that I want to highlight and repeat them even. So you have heard now that never one single international organization works in a given refugee camp. It's always a joint effort, because it would be a far too big and too expensive task for one organization only. And I'm often asked, do you do that in a coordinated manner? Yes, of course. Normally it is coordinated under the United Nations. It might also be coordinated under the state where the refugee camp is based. And it is always in a professional and coordinated manner. The second thing I want to highlight for you is that you have now heard a lot of examples why CARE is focusing on women and girls also in emergency work. I'm so often asked, do you only help women and girls? No, of course not. But they are a special focus group that we are concentrating on and that we are especially addressing. Yeah, because Dr. Musa said it, when he was 12 years old in the refugee camp, he could go to the bathroom at night. This was not an issue, right? You were never harassed or something. But as a girl of 8 or 10 or 12, you are a nearly young adult, you're really exposed. And sometimes such simple things like light is an issue.
Yeah.
And this is the speciality of the global humanitarian work of care, that we respond to the special needs of women and girls. And of course, humanitarian aid always helps men, boys, women, and girls. So I think this is really quite impressive how you shared it with us. And something that I want, before we close, I want to ask you, because you were relatively, don't misunderstand me, it's long enough, but relatively short in this refugee camp. Today, at least the crisis that I have been working with, people spend years in refugee camps. And I think this adds another level of despair and frustration. And this also is very true for most of the Rohingya, right? After 6 years, it is difficult to plan a future.
You are so right that the life of refugee, when they do not know where their life is going to go to, it's extremely hopeless. A feeling of emptiness, feeling of no light in front is quite sad. I have seen my friends, even in the refugee camp, on a few months, they were kind of feeling that maybe that's it, our life finished. So when it's longer term, I have had chance to subsequently work in refugee camps where people have been suffering for a long time. Rohingya refugee camp is one where people are there for years. The last influx took place in 2017 and 19, but there were 300,000 refugees before that for the last 30 years. They were there. They needed help. And it's more than goods and services. It's more than food and shelter and water and medicine. Those are definitely needed. It's more to give them possibilities, give them hope. When they do not know where the hope is, you can still give them a school for kids to get education. So they feel that we can get educated and build a life in future. It's not going away. You can still give them opportunities where they continue their income earning activities. So in the Rohingya refugee camps, now if you visit, you'll see small shops, of vegetable shops, of dry fish shops, of tailoring shops. They're doing it primarily because not only that gives them the opportunity to earn money in addition to the support, but also remain active, remain hopeful.
Structure it, eh?
Yeah, they feel like, okay, so we have reasons to survive. So education, this kind of income earning opportunities, getting into social setting where you can build an evening club where they come together, sing together.
Social life
gives them hopes. These are some of the interventions that are also essential. But one thing, since you mentioned about this coordination, in the Rohingya refugee camp, I was quite impressed. I must emphasize on this, is the role that government of Bangladesh played. They have a strong coordination team. Each of the camp, there is a camp in charge, which is from government of Bangladesh. And then overall, there is a, for the whole refugees, there is a, they call RRC, it's a coordinator. It's the relief rehabilitation coordinator. And they play a role in coordination with UN and others to make sure that we all work together in a way that's not duplicating efforts, that's not keeping the gap on any areas, to make sure that all basic needs, be it food and water and healthcare, or be it longer-term educational needs or giving them hope, are being met, or protection needs
shelter,
are being met.
Shelter, sanitation.
Exactly.
So to use the resources available in the most efficient way. That's why institutions like CARE have to join forces to answer this question that I'm very often asked. And I think the Rohingya are also a very good example. This is a group of people who crossed only one international border into Bangladesh. And in my closing words, I would like to remind us, and I really do hope that the story of Dr. Musa helps all of us maybe to shed a little bit of different light also on the thousands of refugees that are at the frontiers and inside the European Union, and how we look at them and how we live with them. Because nobody becomes a refugee just to have a pleasant life. This is the worst hardship that a human being can experience. Dr. Musa, I really appreciate that you shared your personal life history with us. We do wish you lots of success, and we are really looking forward to our future cooperation. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been an honor to be able to speak with you and partner with CARE Austria. We are grateful that we can work together between us and our colleagues in CARE Austria, but also our colleagues in larger Europe. This means a lot that we care about the world that we would like to see together. Thank you very much, and looking forward to continued cooperation.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. This was CARE in Action, the podcast of CARE Austria with Andrea Barstorff-Hager. For further information, go to care.at. Sponsored by CC Real.